When I was doing my PhD in sociology at Princeton University, Patrick was a junior faculty in the politics department. And I was recruited by the politics department because they needed a woman to play on their co-ed softball team. So Patrick and I got to know each other batting softballs, trying to triumph for our team named Leviathan. And
crypto Hobbesian.
We particularly enjoyed competing against our arch rivals, the invisible hands of the economics department. And the dream crushers of the admissions department. But not to worry, Patrick and I hardly knew each other back then, but I could sense who he was because in between at-bats, or as we celebrated our victories, or equally celebrated our losses, he would inevitably turn to his true idol, de Tocqueville. And I myself, you know, perhaps a naive sociologist at the time, would chime in about who I thought were my 20th century social justice war heroes, Mother Teresa and John Paul II. Well, that I think kind of, I was in sociology and somehow believed that my passion for Catholic social teaching was actually deeply sociological. But over time, I realized that in my own writing, I kind of lacked a kind of theological or philosophical depth. And one story that I like to tell to illustrate what I think is a larger problem in the social sciences of not being able to use the language of being and always turn experiences of faith into something instrumental. In the first book that I published, Faith Makes Us Live, Surviving and Thriving in the Haitian Diaspora, I talk about a woman I met named Stephanie, who had immigrated to the United States from Haiti, and after asking her about all the kind of social justice issues I cared about, I finally asked her, well, why did she move to the U.S.? At which point, she told me that in Haiti, she had been essentially gang raped as an act of political intimidation and fled to the U.S. But she went on to tell me that she forgave the men who raped her, and in fact, she prayed for their conversion, and she knew that in their hearts, they knew that they had done something wrong. But when I wrote about this in my book, I put her words in there, but I said, well, see, this shows that her faith gives her psychological well-being. Now, why did I do that? After I published that book and began to read some of the critiques of the social sciences, people like Charles Taylor, Alasdair MacIntyre, my colleague in sociology, Christian Smith, I began to realize that I always felt that I had to take people's deepest experiences of meaning and purpose and love and turn them into something that promotes upward mobility or psychological stability. But that in doing so, I was actually voiding out people's true experiences. And in that example of Stephanie, it's totally distorting her motivations to think that she chose to forgive people who harmed her because she desired to feel better. You know, maybe murdering them, she might have felt better too. But that's not what she did. So was it really that she felt better, which was the kind of interesting part of this story? So in my next project, I, you know, once again went out and interviewed a bunch of people who had suffered very difficult traumas, and this time I was, you know, convinced that I was going to write about meaning and purpose as constitutive ends, as the highest human ends, as higher than our instrumental goals. But I ran into a lot of trouble in the field of sociology when I began to critique the idea that the deepest reality we can talk about is empirical, that it's at the level of data. And I really just began to question whether or not this ideal of value-free social science isn't actually both empirically flawed, but also morally deficient. To the extent that we take even people's strongest moral commitments and turn them into tools for an instrumental individualist end, which is totally undermining, I think, a lot of the deepest commitments and obligations that people have. So how does this fit into the debates on liberalism? Well, recently, I've been reading the Italian philosopher Augusto Del Noce, and what I wanted to kind of bring to this dialogue about liberalism is that it's not liberalism that's really triumphed in American sociology or psychology, at least not by itself. What I think Del Noce helps us see is that perhaps in the United States we're very focused on liberalism because we think it triumphed in the West, but he actually argues that Marxism, as a philosophy, not as an economic program or as a political program, but that Marxism triumphed as a philosophy in the West because it told us that what we are at base is what we produce, right? We've replaced Homo sapiens, wise people, with Homo faber, what we make, or perhaps Homo economicus, what we buy. And if you look at my field of sociology, I think that there's a very deep entrenched rejection of anything transcendent as being real. Again, it can be admitted to the extent that it's some sort of instrumental variable about some other outcome, but it can't be admitted on the same level as the reality of something material or even something like psychological well-being. So what I liked about Del Noce is he sort of traces for me a lot of what I see in my own field, that this rejection of the transcendent has actually led to the ascendance of a kind of scientism, right? That the only thing we can discuss that's real comes from empirical data. And in doing that, we kind of tend to develop into a technological society where well-being simply means greater and greater mastery over more and more aspects of our lives. But at the same time, this rejection of the metaphysical or the transcendent is the denial that the values that we hold and care about are actually real and lead to also a kind of nihilism about meaning, which I see in a lot of the young people who I work with. But, and this will be my last point about Del Noce, there's much more I could say. I highly recommend you read it, The Crisis of Modernity. But he says it's not just Marxism that's triumphed, that Freudianism has also triumphed. And what does he mean by that? Well, Freud thought that religion was an illusion, but one that we really needed because it really helped us to cope with our suffering. But in the wake of the Freudian separation of our inner self from the transcendent, now our inner self, our desires, become the primary site of our identity. But our desires are no longer connected to any kind of objective, external good. So the only possible kind of moral goal becomes the expansion of this individual well-being and the fulfillment of all of our desires. So Del Noce talks about this kind of curious merging of Marxian revolution with Freudian psychoanalysis, where in fact the true revolution is not necessarily being a proletariat and fighting against the bourgeois, but a true revolution is being a progressive and freeing your repressed, forbidden desires, and in that you're going to become free. So I really think that this kind of interesting conflation between Marxism and Freudianism, I see this a lot, and I won't go into a whole lot of detail, but I see this a lot with our elite students. On the one hand, this hyper-competitiveness that wants to win and achieve, and identity is in what you can make of yourself, with this therapeutic turn that the world is supposed to make us feel good all the time, and that every desire we have is something we're supposed to be able to express and fulfill. So I think as much as I agree with Patrick on the problems, I don't think simply talking about liberalism is going to help us understand what's going on. I try to get my students to read Marx and to read Marcuse, to read, you know, Philip Reif, to read some of the critiques of the therapeutic culture. But I think we need to go deeper than just talking about problems in liberalism and not presume that Marxism and Freudianism are dead or never influenced our culture. So just to end, you know, what do we do in this current moment? Well, I mean, I've become more comfortable saying this and living this. I think we actually do need, in our work with our students in whatever field we are or in our conversations with students, to be honest where we're coming from as Catholic intellectuals or Christian intellectuals. I feel like for a long time I was told or I believed that the best way to be a Catholic intellectual was to just be a better sociologist, but that led to me taking out some of the deeper meaning of what I believed and adopting a vocabulary that I now find very uncomfortable because it distorts the very empirical reality that I want to talk about. But it's not only just talking about Catholicism as an intellectual tradition. I've just become more comfortable talking with students about how much I love being in community, and how much I love the fact that, you know, how I came to know that I need a guide. I need some kind of authority for my conscience, and that I need to be led. That there's a beauty to the sacramental life, and that maybe as Christians, it's okay to go out and celebrate our losses. I don't know, maybe after going to confession, we should go celebrate because we've just received the sacrament of God's mercy. That there's something joyful in this Christian journey that helps us in our everyday life. So I'll just end by saying that I've been very blessed to be a part of this conversation, and I believe that it's by building up community, by being in relationship with the people that we work with, whether or not we agree with them politically or on our faith, that just being present. I do believe it is quite clear in the gospel that we are called to be leaven, we are called to be salt. We're not called to win every argument or win every battle, but I do feel that it's important for us to keep in mind that sometimes being leaven or being salt can actually have a very big influence, even if in the short term we don't feel that we have power.
Thank you, Anita. That's very helpful. And I'd like to thank Candace Vogler for bringing John Stuart Mill so firmly into focus. And I'm going to say a few things about Mill. I think Candace is right to focus on his social philosophy. I think in our deliberations here about Christianity and liberalism, we need to distinguish between what Adrian Vermeule calls the liberalism as a religion from liberal institutions. We're not debating in our society trial by jury or habeas corpus or free and fair elections or other features of liberal political practice. Instead, we're really thinking about the pressure that certain liberal norms, social norms, are putting on us as faithful Christians. And one of the reasons that I think this conference attracts our interest is that we're aware that in 2018, the terms of our participation in American society seem to have shifted over the last decade or two. And we feel pretty acutely that shift, and we're wondering, what role do we play? How do we live as faithful Christians, and how do we engage in public life as faithful Christians? I think Mill is a very important way of thinking about it. Now, for Mill, he wanted a social philosophy that encouraged self-cultivation. And he believed that a stultifying social consensus stood in the way of widespread self-cultivation. And therefore, the great imperative of anyone who cares about the highest good is to diminish the power of the social consensus. I think he was wrong, so that'll be the nature of my remarks to develop that. The fundamental principle of liberalism, it seems to me, is that it is always better that people can do more. It's always better that people can do more. Or at least it's never worse. It's always greater optimal that people can do more or can do things that they could not do before. And that is in the social sphere. They can engage in behaviors and have thoughts that they couldn't have before. Or that in the economic sphere, that they could trade or invest in ways that they couldn't do before, or technologically, that technological advances allow us to do things we could not do before. Now, Mill recognized that needs to be qualified by the harm principle. So it's always better that we could do what we could not do before unless it harms somebody. But I want to submit that this liberal principle is presents greater advantages to the talented than to the untalented. This is obvious in the economic sphere, that greater economic freedom provides more advantages to the talented than to the untalented. And we see this in terms of the way in which... Now, the argument here is that it provides, at least economic growth, that provides resources that are more widely available to everyone, so everyone at some level wins. Although it does require redistribution in order to do that. And in order to redistribute, given human nature, we have to have a very coercive and sort of all-seeing administrative state in order to find the resources that the talented have, taken away from the talented to give to the untalented in order to ensure a Pareto optimal outcome that, in fact, it does lead to the greatest good for the greatest number. And so one of the paradoxes of Millian liberalism is that it actually requires a very all-powerful coercive state in order to remediate the inequalities that are created by the greater economic opportunities for the talented. But it's also true for culture. Greater cultural opportunities, it provide more advantages to the talented than to the untalented. Experiments in living that that Mill endorsed provide opportunities that are often well used by the talented. But those same opportunities are not just, they're often squandered by the untalented. And the experiments in living often lead to disastrous outcomes, as we know. So if I can experiment with alternative family structures as a talented person, I can make it work and maybe even make it work well. But we know that having a society that allows people to experiment with alternative family structures leads to disastrous outcomes for the untalented. And one problem with cultural benefits or cultural advantages is that we cannot redistribute them. We tried with school busing, for instance, was an attempt to allocate, to redistribute cultural advantages. There's tremendous resistance to efforts to redistribute cultural advantages. And the wealthy and the powerful are willing to submit to 50%, total taxation in a place like New York. They are absolutely unwilling to redistribute the cultural advantages that they want to transmit to their children. And so it would take a totalitarian state for us to redistribute cultural advantages. So again, we're back to the Millian paradox, where a true Millian that's concerned about the greatest good for the greatest number is not going to lead to a culture of freedom, or at least a political system of freedom, but it's going to lead to a political system of rigid control over over people's behavior. Ah, the contemporary university. Which is a Millian institution, it seems to me, par excellence. So it strikes me that that one of the problems that we face in contemporary liberalism is a problem we have in Mill, which is if one follows through on the attempt to ensure that the new freedoms are widely beneficial, one sees a diminishment of economic and political freedom. It's a paradoxical situation. But the worst problem in Mill is that there's no Christian element. And as a result, there's no reason for the talented to care about the untalented. There's no reason in his liberalism that anyone among the talented should sacrifice his or her freedom for the sake of the untalented. That's our society today, it seems to me, a meritocratic society where our political and cultural, our economic and cultural politics revolves almost entirely around the interests of the top 10 or 20% of society. So we have a political culture that worries about the top marginal tax rate if you're on the right, or it worries about gay rights and transgender rights on the left. And they're both elite-driven preoccupations and concerns. And I think that follows from the Millian position when you add in human nature, right? Which is that it's the greatest good for the greatest number, but we convince ourselves that what's really good for us is actually good for the untalented. And it's, you know, it's fine. So this is, to my mind, the true state of, and the true source of the decadence of contemporary liberal culture. We have morally deregulated our society, and that was Mill's project. And we've done so for the sake of the talented and at great cost to the untalented. I want to challenge Candace here. Men certainly did violence to children in years past, but in the last 50 years, they've done far more violence to children than they did in previous times. And anybody working with, college students, people who are among the relatively talented, the amount of wreckage in their lives from their broken families, to say nothing of people lower in the social scale, is heartrending. And so I think we have a sort of moral project of re-regulation, cultural re-regulation, that I think is crucial for our society if we're going to move forward as a society of decency, to say nothing of a society that preserves the good and appropriate gains of liberalism over the last 200 years.
Thanks so much. I've already spoken this afternoon, so I'm just going to offer a brief thought or two for Rusty and a brief thought for Marguerite, and I enjoyed both of these presentations very much. For Rusty, my brief thought is that the distinction you draw between liberal social theory and liberal institutions might exist, but that the examples I heard from you are institutions that long predate anything that we might think of as liberalism. So trial by jury, the election, separation of powers, checks and balances are all found in the classical world, in the medieval world. Elections are part and parcel of Aquinas's plan of government. The separation of powers is ultimately stems from Polybius. Now, it's true that these institutions are later colonized in a certain way by liberalism, but there's nothing intrinsically liberal about them. So that was one point. My other, friendly amendment for Rusty is that Mill's thought is not only not Christian, it's specifically anti-Christian. So I'm persuaded by Maurice Cowling that Mill's ultimate project is an anti-Christian project of replacing the clergy with a clerisy, namely those whose capacity for appreciating the higher pleasures, however objective, is greater than that of the common man. For Margarita, my thought was that the phenomena you describe are seem to me absolutely real, but I wasn't sure why we had to describe them under any other rubric than liberalism. They seem to me to fall comfortably under one of the great branches of the liberal family, namely economic liberalism, or, if you like, capitalism. So the individualist and competitive agent who seeks to satisfy his or her preferences, deep yearnings, is a liberal agent. And I just want to read a brief, very brief passage from one of my favorite books, Schmitt's book on Catholicism. "The industrialist has no other ideal than that of Lenin, an electrified earth. They disagree essentially only on the correct method of electrification. American financiers and Russian Bolsheviks find themselves in a common struggle for economic thinking. That is, the struggle against politicians and jurists." And Schmitt sees the antonym of that whole complex to be the essentially juridical rationality of Catholicism. So those are my thoughts for the panelists. Thank you.
Thank you. So I know my official title is moderator, but my hope is to radicalize rather than moderate the panel.
True to form.
In the spirit of the times, we'll see how that goes. We don't want some dreary liberal consensus.
Not for me.
But maybe I'll start with Margarita. And you mentioned, the descent into scientism and tyranny of data and studies. One thing that strikes me about this is, the kind of 1980s sort of conservative critique of liberalism would have been very much liberalism leads to relativism, nihilism, sort of dissipation. And yet what seems to have happened is that, I don't see the kind of campus protesters or what is going on with the constant boycotts and extreme politicization as anything like relativism. They seem very moralistic, have a very clear sense of what they at least think is right, a very clear sense of wrong and sin, if not necessarily any idea of forgiveness. But I'm curious, whether you agree with that and how this kind of lurch into scientism, which occurred especially, another liberal, David Hume, pretty much destroyed empiricism as a way to meaning a long time ago. But as the maybe philosophic culture has become more and more relativist, postmodern, the political culture or scientific culture has become much more rigid and scientistic.
Okay, sure. So I'll try to answer both Adrian's question as well as the other question briefly. I think that my remarks were very brief, but if I understood Patrick Deneen's argument to be that liberalism inevitably leads to the rejection of the transcendent, and I don't see that as an inevitable outcome. And I was trying to point out that Marx and Freud explicitly reject the transcendent as an illusion, as not real. And so it does seem to me a little narrow to focus all of our cultural critique on liberalism and saying that liberalism inevitably does something and ignore that Marx and Freud explicitly do it and say that everything in our culture can be descendant from one piece of thinking that's been dominant. And I just think we should actually not discount the influence of these other theories and say that they're the same as Marx and Freud. So I think we just need to broaden the discussion. Second, I was at Yale during the student protests, and they feel their feelings very strongly. I don't deny that, but it's very clear to me that their feelings are not based on a concept of universal reason. So that's my point. I'm not at all, do I think my field of sociology doesn't have people with extraordinarily strong values and opinions, but they will not give those values and opinions the category of being based on reason and truth. In fact, it's their special position somehow or another that gives them access to truth about those feelings, not reason. And this, to me, is a very important distinction and makes it extremely hard to dialogue about those values because you are disqualified from the dialogue because of your position, your skin color, your race, your gender, your class, your something, right? So the disagreements with the protesters are not disagreements based on reason. The disagreements are based on because of where you're coming from. You can't see the truth. So this is what I heard again and again and again. So the point I was trying to make is that we've reached a point where what makes your viewpoints true is how strongly you feel them, not the kind of evidence that you offer for them.
My view is that political correctness is obligatory non-judgmentalism. So you are required to be non-judgmental, or it's obligatory disenchantment. You're obliged to adhere to a negative Sinai, where thou shalt not judge. And I think it's perfectly consistent and coherent. I mean, there's an end that they seek, and I think Mill is it's a complicated thinker, and this is a reductio ad absurdum of Mill, but it's obligatory. We're all obliged to build a culture where everyone can cultivate their lives as they see fit, and that means that anyone who has a thick theory of the good, in the Rawlsian sense, is a person who is morally repugnant. That they're dangerous people who are threatening the project of liberalism. And the project of liberalism is to create the greatest possible scope for experiments in living. That's why the transgender stuff is so important, because it's emblematic. I mean, if you can do that, then what can't you do? And it's, it's always good that people can do things that they couldn't do before. And so if people can change sex, then that's a powerful witness to all of us that we have tremendous freedom to be and do anything that we want. Now, the problem is that it's created a culture of profound, all these taboos, thought control. Not just that, but it's created a culture of incredible conformity. Here you have these super talented students at a place like Harvard that they're all individuals in exactly the same way. And there's a tremendous, I was told by a student from an elite university, I asked about classes and stuff, and he said to me, the one imperative is never say what you're actually thinking. Okay? Anti-Millian outcome. Anti-Millian outcome. I mean, he wanted people to speak, frankly. And that's the marketplace of ideas. But to create space for people's experiments in living, we have to minutely monitor our every statements to ensure that we don't transgress or in any way create any kind of atmosphere of moral norms that might impinge upon people's self-chosen experiment in living. So we get exactly the opposite outcome. And again, that's, I think, why we feel that we're living in a very decadent and dysfunctional cultural moment. Because what our dominant culture says it's promoting feels to us to be quite the opposite. It's not just religious folks, as we all know, insofar as we're engaged in university culture, it's not just religious folks that feel that. A lot of people feel that. They think, this is a kind of ruthless environment. Many good-hearted liberals in the old sense have deep misgivings, but they have no place to turn. They don't really have a vocabulary with which to articulate any alternative.
Speaking of articulating an alternative, if one wanted to caricature perhaps your remarks, I think it sounds like your concern with today's liberalism is one that it's too organized. It's organized solely for the benefit of the elite. And in that sense, it's not actually achieving the greatest good for the greatest number. And I wonder if that critique, would a critique made in the name of, to borrow Professor Vermeule's phrase, a comprehensive substantive theory of the good, even if it was not good, not the greatest good for the greatest number, an alternative to liberalism built on that, would you be able to critique liberalism on that sense, or are we stuck critiquing liberalism from within the framework of the utilitarian greatest good of the greatest number?
Well, that's a great question, and I think that there's something right about the Millian position. So, this is the point. So, if we only use the terms of liberalism to describe our situation, we're just going to sort of go back into the same cycle over again. And Adrian pointed that out, that, this is the remark about from the stand.
She's called this thing, yeah.
About how the seeds of where we are now are in the past. But there is something right about the notion that we want the life we live to be possessed by us. I mean, I want to actually live my life. I want to enter into it and possess it and own it. And that, you know, I remember I was here in Boston last summer, and I met with somebody in Concord, and I made my pilgrimage up the hill to Emerson, Hawthorne, and Thoreau's graves, and because they're part of me. You know, they're not altogether wrong, although where they were wrong, they were disastrously wrong. the disaster is being manifest in our time, but they're not altogether wrong. And I feel the same way about utility. When a society, if we say that, as Father Legge does, that you know, use is the fair, that we accord to things that which they are due, well, certainly in a well-functioning society, you know, to accord a decent way of life to the untalented is what they are due, a decent way of life, not a glorious, high-achieving. You know, I find myself very exasperated by our rhetoric and our political rhetoric. Everyone's going to go to college and everyone's going to work for Goldman Sachs. And there's no sense that what most people want is a decent life. You know, and that's increasingly inaccessible. And so this, these observations in the mode of both social, and that was part of Mill's correct emendation of utilitarianism, to recognize that there are social cultural goods and not just, you know, portable material goods. So I think you can go both ways on this, precisely because liberalism, however defective it is, does identify real goods that I think we can articulate from a Thomistic perspective.
And one question to Adrian before opening it up. Sort of along the lines of, you know, it's, you can't go back to pre-68 liberalism or whatever. It struck me walking over here that, I don't know, maybe 50 years ago, if you saw a poster for a conference called Christianity and Liberalism, what you would expect to find would be a lot of people talking about secularization, one angle or another of how liberalism is somehow a product of or a logical outcome of Christianity. I wonder, you know, is there some, certainly since the beginning of modern liberalism, they have been intertwined in very complex ways, but I wonder how you view the relationship between liberalism and Christianity, if any, and perhaps how that may have changed, say, since the so-called end of history.
A small question. Thank you, Julie. I can't begin to say anything general about that, except let me indicate two methodological points that I invoked earlier today and will continue to invoke as need be as we go on. One is that all political concepts are bound to a concrete polemical situation. That is, what we might have meant by liberalism and Christianity 50 years ago is not the same sort of problem that we would mean today. The secularization problem might be the problem seen from the standpoint of a society in which Christianity is at a certain point dominant or at least majoritarian and is becoming less so. Our problem today, especially for Catholicism, is what I indicated to be the kind of core problematic of Old Testament Jewish political theory, which is how to function as a minority in an intermittently hostile regime. So that to me is the core problem today. I'll just leave that there. Thank you.
Could I speak to that? Am I allowed to? Okay, Julius, thank you.
I appreciate your liberal deference to the Lord.
As St. Paul says, for freedom, Christ has set you free. Professor Brog's lecture I missed last night, unfortunately. But we were not made to be slaves of worldly powers. That's what the gospel says. we're made for life. Jesus says, I come to give you life and life abundant. And so we're made to live as God created us to live, and not as slaves to worldly powers. In our time, of course, those worldly powers are success, wealth, and so forth. And so in that sense, obviously, the Millian notion of self-cultivation, self-possession, the Emersonian, to thine own self be true, this clearly grows out of that root, that Christian root that has analogs in the classical realm as well. What we've lost is, again, I think this is, I put this, again, Mill's, I don't want to put anything, but Mill's useful because he's a deep and pure thinker. But Mill thought that the greatest threat to this is commandment from the outside. And I think this misjudges, this obviously can be true. It's wrong to think that it's commandment from the outside. The commandment of unjust authority or illegitimate authority is the greatest source of enslavement. Commandment from just authority and legitimate authority is the greatest source of freedom. And so when St. Paul is knocked down on the road to Damascus, he does not ask God, Christ, well, what does this mean? Doesn't even ask what is truth. He asks, what should I do? He asks for a commandment. So it's Sinai is the source of freedom. And the great, what we need to do, and I'm even, Adrian wants to know how to survive in our time. I'm interested more in the St. Cecilia side of things, which is how do we triumph in our time? Because our fellow citizens desperately need us in this time. And of course, that might mean, in the interim, exercising what authority we have wisely and for the common good, and even covertly, given the amount of external pressure. So I agree with him that may be our vocations for some of us. But some of us should really be shouting from the rooftops that is what is humans need. They need legitimate authority in order to be free from bondage to their own self-incurred self-destructive ways of life. We need a good paternalism.
Yeah, I just want to underscore, I couldn't agree more. I think we have a short-run problem and a long-run problem, and there's no reason we can't have some working on both scales. That's the contrast between Mordecai, Esther, Daniel, and Joseph on the one hand, and St. Paul on the other hand, who preaches from within the heart of the Imperium, namely Cambridge.
Thank you so much. That's a two-pronged question for Professor Reno. Professor Reno, it struck me at the outset of your remarks you mentioned...
It hurts already, both prongs.
Well, the second prongs are Professor Mooney, but the link or the definition you define liberalism as always being about more, which struck me as remarkably similar to Matthew Rose's summary in your publication a few weeks ago of Spengler's views about the West being having this permanent striving for infinity, and he links everything from the West's incredible cathedrals, Sochart, Mont Saint Michel, and everything, literature, operas, polyphony, everything, to the striving for infinity. So if you accept the link, and if you don't, then you're going to toss out my question, but if you accept the link between liberalism as being about more and this sort of deep-seated Western longing for infinity, then why do we view liberalism as this sort of cancer from the outside that's with some definite starting point, whether it's William of Ockham or the birth of perspective or scholasticism, God forbid, or heavy social and economic organization, Marxism. Why do we always view liberalism as having sort of an invasive starting point rather than viewing it as maybe the embodiment of Occidentalism? Are we maybe in our present moment, are the protests at Yale a better embodiment of being Western than we've ever seen before? And the
the personalization of the political is purely the next frontier. And, you know, maybe it's our modern cathedral, you know, maybe it's our line for infinity. So are you willing to endorse a program of de-Occidentalization to get us away from that? And then, or to reintroduce other sources. And then for Professor Mooney, yes, I'll be fine, I'll sleep.
Yes, the Faustian striving. I'm inclined to think that I think multiculturalism, this is only in the West. It's clearly, a sort of expression of this universal striving. But it's lost its transcendent orientation, I think. Margarita and I agree on that. And so it becomes politicized, and we seek things out of the political that the political can't give us. So it leads to idolatries and perversions in the political realm. And so that striving, there is a horizontal dimension to the striving, it's fitting, but ultimately it needs to be subordinate to the transcendent striving, the vertical.
Thank you very much. I'd like to address a couple of questions to this panel and all of the participants in the conference. A lot of work has been done in order to recover or vindicate a certain positive or rightly understood form of liberty. And then I believe that there's a kind of shared assumption that this liberty, well understood, can be put to work in the liberal framework, and together we can achieve the classical and Christian ideal of free people striving toward the good in society. However, I find it striking that we don't look to the flourishing Christian societies of, the liberal order after the French Revolution for inspiration. It seems like they're not there. So is something going terribly wrong with liberalism in this sense? Why don't we see these virtuous communities and these virtuous individuals or the great achievements piling up on top of each other? It seems like we experience the symptoms of cultural decay and disharmony. The second part of this is concerns the idea of the marketplace of ideas and that versus free inquiry. Is there a sense in which we sort of abdicate the pursuit of truth to the idea, to the marketplace of ideas? Do we start over every single time? Is every student, a Lockean tabula rasa? Is every field constantly going to reinvent itself? Or is there some way to build upon progress and pass that down? Thank you.
I mean, I could venture an answer, though. I'm not entirely sure I understood the two parts of your question, but I would certainly be someone who thinks that part of our response to the situation today would be to look at some very hopeful examples of Christian communities that are thriving in our culture. And I see new schools being founded. I see new communities being founded. So I don't buy into the idea that modernity was a linear progress, nor the critics who say everything is going down. And my idea of what it means to be faithful and to be hopeful today means to actually look at some of the really positive, creative examples of people who are living out their values and who are being leavened and who are, I think, making some change, even though things can often be difficult.
Sitting down and standing up, so I'm going to stay here. This is for Mooney, but also from really anyone. You mentioned the powerful, I guess, emotivism that is behind the Yale movements and really every movement nowadays. I've seen images of the metaphor of like riders on an elephant, that people's hearts and emotions and desires are this elephant, that if you can't motivate the elephant to move in a direction, then there's no point in speaking to the reason, which is the rider on top, even though ideally the rider should be directing the elephant. So I guess in terms of how do we triumph in our time, how can we, and nowadays we see how powerful emotions are, like fear and outrage and pleasure, to motivate people's elephants, so to speak, people's hearts, to do these mass movements. How can we, not manipulatively, but speak to the desires, the loves, the fears, the emotions of people to create real movement for positive good, other than being, or is it simply limited to us in our one-on-one family, friend, familial, colleague circles of being leaven? Is there a way for us to concretely, in addition to, like, I guess, like the people in the realm of ideas being the Daniels and the Esthers infiltrating the regime, but I'm talking more about like my family, my friends, the masses. How do we motivate them to move towards a common good, and speaking to their desires that way?
Again, I will try to venture an answer, though I don't think I have a perfect one. But I would just say that I think one of the reasons I'm on this panel, and perhaps one of the elephants in the room that hasn't been named yet, is that there are some people who are extremely pessimistic about our abilities to make change in this society. And one turning point for me was having a discussion with students who told me that they thought we were less free in the United States today than people had been under the Soviet Union. And my response to that is the beginning of my response to you. We do live in a country with freedom of association, with freedom of religion. You are free not just to talk to your immediate relatives, but to found an association, to start a movement, right? So we actually live in a liberal regime that has given us certain rights that perhaps we've not exercised because other people have been exercising them. But it is possible, right? And again, I think some of the young people I talk to maybe don't realize what an incredible privilege it is to live in this country and be able to do that. And so I would say that what exactly is your call or anybody else's call, I don't know. But in that sense, I'm like my friend Patrick Deneen, that I believe in voluntary associations and starting movements. And I recently hosted a young woman, Leah Libresco, for some Scala events with my students. And her answer was, you know, we don't need to found a school or, you know, start a new movement, but we can open up our homes for dinner and prayer on Friday nights and just send out an email and ask people to come. And we just brainstormed about creative ways that don't require a movement or lots of resources, where the interior resources we have, the intellectual resources, the faith resources, we're just intentional about sharing them with the people around us right now in really simple ways. I'm also all for and very encouraging of those people who do go found a school or start a movement, but I don't think you have to. And I really do believe that change needs to go from the smallest level up.
May I say something a little bit? I think register a slight dissent or perhaps just question about something Margarita just said. I think when students say we feel less free in America today than citizens of the Soviet Union, or when the Polish politician and thinker Ryszard Legutko says that unfreedom under EU liberalism is comparable to unfreedom under communism in Poland, there's a sense in which that's quite problematic, maybe absurd on its face. However, there's another, and I think equally important, sense in which we ought to try to understand what they're saying and hear what the complaint is and interpret it without dismissing it. And I note that Margarita's examples of liberal privileges were all freedoms from direct state coercion, whereas perhaps what these people are referring to is a kind of horizontal social coercion that comes from the pressure of social norms under liberalism. So under liberalism, there's this striking conformity that Rusty referred to, that one sees among students, that one sees among cultural institutions, that one sees among corporations. And this striking conformism doesn't result from the action of a central controller, but it seems to happen in the way that a school of fish moves, through horizontal interactions among those in the conforming group. And I think that sense of unfreedom from that sort of pressure is very real and should be taken very, very seriously.
Yeah, to follow up on that, I think, if you, how do I put this? The young people that come to my office don't feel that they have any political choices. When I was a college student, if you thought capitalism was bad, then you entertained the possibility of socialism. And what's striking is post-89, the closing of the aperture of the political imagination. And that's why, right, it's one reason why this conference is interesting, is people want to open the aperture up and experiment with, 13th century France or whatever. And this is an exercise of political imagination. It's not a concrete proposal for America. It's an exercise of political imagination. It's healthy. And I think it's to be encouraged. But that's the kind of unfreedom. So for a certain kind of intellectually oriented person, it feels very claustrophobic politically. And then for a lot of young people, wow, you can't make any mistakes as you climb the greasy pole towards success. And when I tell the young interns that I failed a class as an undergraduate because I stopped going to my differential equations class when I lost interest halfway through the semester and took the final exam, they're flabbergasted. I mean, and you are able to become editor first thing you failed in class. So they feel this kind of, you can't take a single step. I mean, here we have this fabulously wealthy country, these incredibly talented kids coming to these super over-endowed universities. You would think that they would have this tremendous feeling of freedom, open possibilities. Instead, they walk lockstep behind each other through these narrow, narrow entryways, anxious about internships and never taking an actual job from ever. I mean, people here in law students have never had a job because you can't afford to have a job. Because you have a job, that doesn't mean a regular job like working at Walmart, then that doesn't help your resume. So you're always interning and working on this and doing that. And somehow, I just think to myself, that's slavery. Wow, that's slavery. And so in that sense, the million, again, Mill's a very problematic character in my book, but the things he sees are real, even if he fails to recognize what the true solution is.
Just briefly, can I just respond briefly? So just briefly, I absolutely believe that students feel a lot of social coercion. I said that I agree with a lot of the description of Patrick Need's problem. I think the question I'm raising is social coercion that we just heard described, is it a result of liberalism? And what I hear in these discussions is that students who feel social coercion want more state authority or university authority to enforce their viewpoint, and they want less liberalism and more state. And I find that questionable as both a diagnosis of why they feel that coercion, which is real, as well as is that really the right response. And I've taken to sometimes saying, how much is it social coercion that you don't speak your views, or how much is it that you're incredibly ambitious and want everybody to like you and promote you to these goals that you're not willing to think that there might be other ways of flourishing other than towing a line because it's going to get you a letter of recommendation to get you into a particular school that's going to get you a particular income that's going to get you to a particular position that you've decided you need. So when is it that students are not speaking the truth out of their own narrow self-interest?
Hi. I'm a student at Harvard Law School and Catholic.
Oh, okay.
And my experience at Harvard Law School and at other prominent universities, hearing from other people, is that the main ideology there is corporate liberalism. It's culturally liberal and then economically corporate. 4 out of 5 students go to work for the wealthiest and most powerful entities. after school, you start talking about morals, they say, stop judging me. But so cultural liberalism also happens, economic liberalism. When people try to thicken the morality at, say, Harvard Law School on cultural liberalism, all the conservative Christians come out to support them. When people try to thicken the morality on economic liberalism, all the conservative Christians are silent. And that's been my experience at other places too. What do you think accounts for the reason, accounts for, you know, mainstream conservative Christian leaders standing up to cultural modernism but not standing up to corporate power and economic modernism? And how can we build the bravery of them to stand up, you know, to the level that they're standing up to some recent thing in the culture or Hollywood, to stand up to Walmart and Microsoft and the like? So.
My simple answer is that Harvard Law School needs more Catholics. So let me explain. So your dimension of conservative liberal doesn't actually map well onto Catholic social thought, which is, from a certain standpoint, you know, quite left on social and economic issues, at least in some dimensions. So that when you say conservative Christians only care about cultural issues and not about the other side of things, I think, and without meaning to offend anyone, I think that's a special pathology of American evangelical Christianity.
Well, I wouldn't put it all on. I wouldn't put it all on evangelical.
Oh, let's do. Sure.
I think that part of it is that it is the case that evangelical Christians have. An anti-government sentiment is deep in the Free Church Protestant tradition. That's at the core of evangelical Christianity. That's certainly true. But part of it is we tend to take our political views wholesale, not retail. And the fact of the matter is that since the 1970s, people who cared deeply about cultural deregulation and wanted to prevent it found themselves allied with people who wanted economic deregulation. And so, and moreover, if you, like me, were young in the 70s and couldn't get a job, and because of the stagnation of that time, a lot of the cultural deregulatory imperatives made sense. And they were effective. And I don't regret supporting them. It's just that in our own time, the challenges are different. And so I think that there's widespread rethinking. I wouldn't say rethinking, but adjustment about how conservative Christians think about economic matters. I think there's, as is everyone, is rethinking in the present moment. So maybe that'll change. Who knows? Do you have some proposals in mind?
Well, I'm just interested in, you said, you know, the issue of you said that the issue of trans teens or something is something that we all need to stand up for. This is a huge fight. And yet, you know, a fifth of children in poverty, usury happening, you know, is not even the Catholic definition of usury, but, you know, the foreclosure crisis.
Right. Like,
is that something we all need in this room to stand up for as well?
No, but
or is that a slight adjustment?
No, that, I mean, the problem with economic matters is that it's often hard to tell what helped. Because economic matters are not merely a matter of utility, but that's a strong element of it. And so it's just hard to know which tax policies are actually going to be beneficial to people on the bottom 20% and which aren't. It's hard to know which some patterns of redistribution we know over time actually do more harm than good. The war on poverty was, I'm sure I probably would have supported it in 1965, but in retrospect, it did actually a great deal of harm, it seems, and we can debate about that. Whereas the taking of an innocent life and abortion is that's not subject to complex judgments of prudence, political prudence. That seems to be much clearer, and that's why one can be quite black and white on that issue and more nuanced on the economic issues.
Yes, question directed to Adrian. Right here, so I have to move back because of the sound. They told me. We've heard a lot at this conference about liberalism and Catholicism. It was absolutely fascinating. I'd love to introduce another ism, nationalism, which is big these days, I suppose. And the question I have is has to do with I guess the triangulation that might be happening or can happen. Well, historically, at least in the Anglo-American Protestant world, liberalism has used nationalism to sort of, you know, push out maybe Catholicism or Catholic teaching. Is there a way that maybe Catholicism can leverage or use nationalism today in its Christian strategy against liberalism?
So from one standpoint, nationalism is a danger, and from another, it's an opportunity. So let me explain both. The standpoint from which nationalism is a danger is that there are many alternatives to liberalism. In some of them, you know, fascism, communism, or the kind of national versions of integralism are, you know, condemned in at least in certain dimensions by Catholic social and political thought. So that one must be wary of them. The sense in which they're an opportunity is that I think they can have exemplary or demonstration effects. So when the Polish nationalist Catholic regime declares, when the president, parliament, and bishops of Poland assemble and declare that the sovereign of the Polish nation is Jesus Christ enthroned, it illustrates a political possibility that can be mind-expanding for liberals, even if it arises out of a substrate of nationalism. So that's, I think, an opportunity.
I would say, too, back to the economic question that, I mean, there are two natural laws and one supernatural law. Well, there are three natural laws. I mean, the love of God, or at least the desire for God, is natural. And then the tria, love of one's homeland, and then family, love of one's, you know, one's domestic, the domestic realm. All three are under threat right now in our world, and they're linked. And so, to Adrian's point, because they are linked, and they're all three weakened by the current regime. And so, and that regime has an economic dimension as well as a cultural dimension. And so, insofar as the impulse is to sort of renew the patriotic love, that can be linked to other renewals, both down to the family and up to the religious. And I think, obviously, it's dangerous, but I'm with Adrian. I think that there needs to be some prudent, you know, one needs to be prudent and discern where those impulses, because in terms of those three loves, the one that's the most cost-free is a patriotic love. Especially if you're my age, you're not likely to be called to make any sacrifices for your nation. So I can feel very warm in my desire to be loyal without having to sign any checks. In contrast to my family and, of course, obedience to God. So it's a natural point where people are going to want to reconsolidate around something other than utility and its circulation through society, and other than the negative freedom of being able to do what I want.
I have a question for Adrian, perhaps
I can't say
for Rusty as well. In his commentary on Genesis, Leon Cass makes this observation of Joseph, that he has two dreams, one having to do with stalks of wheat bowing down to him, and one having to do with celestial bodies bowing down to him. And he further observes that Joseph does not live in an agrarian society or in a mythological system where the sun and moon and stars bow down, but the Egyptians do. And then he has this beautiful pithy line, the problem with Joseph is that Egypt is in him before he is in Egypt. So the question I have for you is, given that it seems there's this undercurrent in some of the stories in the Bible of capitulation, what are the benchmarks that you would see which, when crossed, suggest to you that Catholics and Christians more broadly, by virtue of their participation in these large secular institutions, have so capitulated that the only right answer is to hold the ejection seat? And I'm thinking particularly here of somebody, the insight of someone like Jamie Smith, for whom these institutions have their own liturgies, and they actually form your loves merely by participating in them.
I have to be very brief because we want to leave time for Father Thomas Joseph to wrap up. I'll just say something very quick, which is you've given a version of a standard objection to ralliement, either in the naive or strategic version, which is that the participation in liberal institutions itself so forms the mind of the participator that liberalism colonizes those who would work within it. I think that's not necessarily true for institutions that long predate liberalism, are not intrinsically liberal, and that will certainly be present in a post-liberal society. An example of that, I think, is bureaucracy, which has nothing intrinsically liberal about it, despite a widespread assumption to the contrary. So I'll just have to leave that there.
Wonderful. We might wrap it there, and please help me in joining and thanking